Now I'd call to order the study session, Mesa City Council for Thursday. Still in the holidays. Thursday, January 6th, 2011. The first item on the agenda is to review the agenda for this coming Monday's council meeting. Items 3A through 3D. 4A through 4D, Councilmember Higgins.
Item 4B, as 4B. Mayor, is there anyone from the fire department? Or all right, I'll just throw the question out. I just want to know how long these defibrillators last.
Hopefully long enough.
The question is, do we always buy these type of pieces of equipment on with bond funds? Because they're tabletop things. They're not big, you know.
Right, but we typically buy the equipment for the vehicles,
yes.
And so this becomes part of those. These are fairly
expensive, yes.
As you can tell. And so it's a combination of the fire bonds and grant dollars. But they do. My understanding is that one, this is a new technology for us. These heart monitors. So this gives us more information about the patient that we're dealing with. We have funded equipment that, and I don't know that this is going to be a 20-year asset, but I think it certainly goes 5 or 7 years at least.
Okay, so, great.
It's a good question, but that's, as far as funding available, that was the best source we had at the
okay.
time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, anything else? Great, items 4E through 4G. Councilmember Higgins.
Items 4F, as in Frank. This was, you know, we overordered basically. And in your little statement there, in your staff report, it says, we'll remind staff to look something up first. Is there a more foolproof system than remember to look to make sure you've not overspent?
Yeah. Councilmember Higgins. Short answer here is staff. Did not track a purchase properly. This item was ordered in April and not delivered to November. In the meantime, additional purchases were made. We had attempted to purchase this with the regular purchase order first. It was determined it could be done on the blanket purchase order, and it wasn't tracked properly. So we do have in place now, we are tracking to the cent on that blanket purchase order, so I don't expect this to happen again.
Okay, great. I just want follow-up system. Awesome. Thank you.
Councilmember Finter.
Dan.
Hold on.
You know, I just want to say one of the positives of this, I think it's great that we have it here, is everybody's taking a look at how we do purchasing and contracts and things, and really appreciated to see no one gets slammed. We're just trying to fix, you know, make sure the system's right. So I think it's wonderful that we can bring this up, have it taken care of, and get things going. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, and just is the City Edge, will that... It really is going to help these type of things, right? The computer system's going to be.
It's going to solve all problems as we know them today.
And your budget problems.
Yeah, the world will be a whole different place.
At least that's what they tell you.
That's what they're telling me.
Okay.
You should see what it's going to do for immigration. It's amazing.
Great. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, by the way, I forgot to welcome everyone back. I hope you all had a happy holiday. Okay, now back to business. Items 4H through 5E. Councilmember Higgins.
Item 4B is the first time the local government investment pool came up.
Oh. Yeah. 5B.
I'm sorry, 5B. Could someone explain that?
No, we actually invest into the local government investment pool. That's where we do... The majority of our investments have for many years, although recently I have encouraged staff and we've developed gone outside of the local government investment pool to go into more of a private sector, complying with our investment policy. And we're going to have a report for council on that this month. But this is a requirement of the grant that we have to invest, place our dollars in the Arizona Local Government Investment Pool, which is where the majority of our funds are invested today.
Okay.
We are going to bring to audit finance this month, I can't remember which day, we're going to talk a little bit about our strategy there, because that's not necessarily the most beneficial location to park our dollars. But this is a requirement of the grant.
Great. And then, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to go on and just talk and give kudos to Corrine Nystrom and her staff for all those, that whole series of resolutions that are coming up on airport improvements, and what a great job. And I'm looking forward to a much even safer airport than already safest airport of the year award. Safety, safe.
Thank you, thanks. Councilmember Higgins. We do, we're trying to do our best.
We do. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, anything else? Items 5F through 7A. Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you, Mayor. You know, item 5E was the library reciprocal borrowing.
Go back to 5E.
Yeah, because you're too fast, and I'm on my high-tech new device. I'm learning, and it's working awesome. Is there any library person that, you know, this is important, of course, and I just wanted to know if you wanted to throw out any comments, Heather, on your thoughts, because there's options for us here.
At this point, the staff is recommending that we go ahead with this IGA. Next year, we will evaluate whether we will participate in this agreement again. Okay. But we wanted to give ourselves a little bit of time to see if maybe this year we'll make a little money through the county, through the IGA. Okay. If we don't, then next year we would like to consider pursuing not participating and charging non-residents a library card fee.
So has the expiration date really helped get people every year to renew their cards?
Councilwoman Higgins, yes. We are finding that we are picking up more non-residents than we realized we had, because we're expiring our cards on a regular annual basis, and we are using the city search database to really track people's addresses, because you can have, of course, a Mesa address but not be a Mesa resident. You can be a County Island resident, and so we are tracking those much more carefully. Staff are getting very good at using that database and identifying those users of the library who are not Mesa residents.
And will City Edge help Heather in her library issues?
Oh. I'm not sure it's going to be checking out books, but it'll help her collect fees and fines.
Okay, awesome. All right. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. 5F through 7A. Nothing? You're good for the rest of the meeting?
Yeah, I'm going to take a nap now.
Okay. All right. And 7B. Okay. All right, and the next item is to hear a presentation, discuss, provide direction on the proposed development agreement between the City of Mesa and Crescent Crown.
Good morning, Mayor and Council members. Today we're here to talk about the Crescent Crown project. To my left is Rich Marchant. He's the Vice President of Operations for Crescent Crown Distribution. And one of the things that we'd like to talk about is Crescent Crown is decided to come to Mesa, relocation from Phoenix. They will be located at 1640 West Broadway. The facility will be approximately 300,000 square foot with over 450 jobs, with an estimated cost for the facility to be about $20 to $25 million. There's various pieces of the project that include a development agreement and designation of a redevelopment area, which I'll get into a little bit later in the project. First, we'd like Mr. Marchant to go over a little bit about what the project entails and where we're going from here.
Good morning, Mayor, Councilman. Crescent Crown is a beverage wholesaler. We've operated in the valley here now under different entities for 100 years, actually in 2011. And this site in Mesa for us is actually a bit of a homecoming, because the business was founded as Zeb Pearson Sons, not far from here, almost 100 years ago this year. So the site for us is good for that reason, and more than that, it's a perfect location for our business. It's a 23-acre site. We distribute beverages from there, beer, some wine, and some non-alcoholic beverages like Welch's, Sunny Delight, and some other items. I want to walk you through now the site that we've chosen here on Broadway Road. It's a redevelopment site. There's a building, if you look off to the east side there, there's a 35,000 square foot building. We plan to demolish that, put some of our parking in our shop area there. And then the other two large parcels there is where our building will be located. You'll take a look. This is looking, I believe, west into the site from Longmore and Broadway. It's a field now that's been in agriculture as far back as we can tell since 1918 is when the irrigation ditch was put in there. So it's been vacant that long. And then this is the building here, the 35,000 square foot building that we plan to demolish as part of the project. And then here's a picture rendering of the actual building that we plan to build on the site. The building, again, as Patrick said, this is our corporate office for Arizona. We're up to over 50,000 square feet of office, and we have 450-odd employees that will be located out of that building, but it will also serve as the home for the greater Phoenix area, where we have another 250 employees that work out of Surprise, and the sales departments from those locations will come into this location as also as our corporate headquarters. So in and out, there's 600 people that will be utilizing this facility. And there's just another shot a little further out. This is our lobby area. We tried to carry the architecture of the site in, and really our goal was I'm a longtime Mesa resident. I grew up just a half a mile from where this building is going to be located. So it's really important for us to bring something into the community. So we look at this building as really setting the standard of style to bring that back into this neighborhood.
As I mentioned in the first part of this presentation, in order to bring in Crescent Crown to the city of Mesa, there are a couple things that we're offering to them. The first is to customize their project schedule. They would actually like to break ground, start construction in March of this year, the first week of March. Towards that end, we're working with them to customize that schedule. We're also working with our partners with Maricopa County Workforce to help them with workforce training funds in a grant amount of about $100,000 for all new employees that they bring in. The other thing that we're working with them on is a reduction in property tax. The state code allows us to use what's called the government property lease excise tax. The city of Mesa has used it before in a downtown project, and we've also are working on the DMB project at Gateway to offer the GIPLET government property lease excise tax. City of Tempe and City of Phoenix use this extensively, and it's one of the incentives that the state does offer us in order to entice businesses to come to Mesa. In order to take full advantage of the GIPLET process, we will need to designate the property as a redevelopment area. And in the staff report, there's the findings that you'll need to make in February when that comes forward, adopting a resolution that will designate that as a redevelopment area. This project is also located in the Enterprise Zone, in Mesa's Enterprise Zone, so we're going to help them take advantage of that state and incentive program as well. The next steps are, staff is anticipating bringing back the development agreement, which again includes the use of GIPLET via a 20-year lease with Crescent Crown. And also designating the property as a redevelopment area at your February 7th meeting. We are already started the design review process. Last night, the design review board did a preliminary review of the plans, the renderings that you just saw now, as well as our site plan and landscape plan, and that went very well. The board was very pleased with the application that was submitted, and really didn't have any comments besides that they thought it was a great project and they look forward to seeing it on the 19th, where they'll consider the application at that point. We have scheduled or are actually scheduling a groundbreaking ceremony on January 26th at 10 in the morning at the site. You'll notice that that's before the February 7th date that we're asking you to approve the development agreement and the redevelopment designation. Crescent Crown is working on an at-risk grading permit, and basically that means that they'll be grading the site at their risk. Escrow should be closing January 20th, and so it's we're just working through this process, and we look forward to bringing these back to you on February 7th. And I forgot to mention that they anticipate completing the project in February of 2012.
Mr. Brady.
So, Mayor and Council, one of the things I think is key for Crescent Crown is that I think we've had an opportunity. There's been a couple of different press releases, briefings with the council. We know there can't be any decisions today of the development agreement, but certainly they're relying upon our good faith and moving forward with this development agreement as they move forward with the closing of their property and the grading of their property. So I think one of the purposes for today's meeting was also that if there's any questions or concerns from council, we'd like to probably try to address those as early as possible before they get even further along in their development, as they are recognizing the council obviously has full discretion when it makes the decisions on the development agreement. But one, this was to kind of come out even more publicly and make the presentation, but also if there are any questions or concerns, we try to address those today as they move forward with grading and closing the property.
Okay. Councilman Richens.
Yeah, I think it's a great project. It's going to really do wonders for Broadway Road. I hope with the Lincoln redevelopment of the old Motorola site down the street and this, there's getting to be some good energy. In the Giplet Law, there's some percentages that help keep the school districts whole as far as the money that flows back. And can you briefly talk about that and the property taxes that are collected for the school district now? It's been vacant, as you said, forever.
Only since 1918.
That's right. Just what was there before that? A shanty or something? Oh, no. So if you could talk about what gets collected now as a vacant parcel and then what gets collected on the Giplet Law, there's percentages that go to each district and how that kind of keeps the school district whole so they don't suffer under this a loss of revenue under this.
Councilmember Richens, if you wouldn't mind, I want to look at my notes so I get the percentage rates correctly.
Yeah. It's like 7 and 20 and 20. And
a couple things, Councilmember Richens and council members. As part of this process, when we offer Giplet, one of the things that state code requires is that we do an economic analysis of the project. And that has to be done by a third party. And Dave Fackler is in the audience. He is a consultant that we hired to perform this economic analysis. So if you have any additional questions on that report that was included in the staff report, he's here today to come up and answer that. Specifically to your question, the statutes outline specifically how the Giplet revenue is distributed. And it goes like this. The county gets 13%. The city of Mesa gets 7%, community college gets 7%, and then Mesa Unified School District gets 73% of those revenues that come in. The I'm not sure if I heard your entire question, but I think you asked how is the current property tax, and that's it's a typical your primary tax rate and then your secondary property tax rate. And in the analysis that Mr. Fackler did, it points out one of the things that it has to point out is that the benefits that Crescent Crown receives are not more so than the benefits that the community receives.
Well, another way of saying it is you have vacant land that's been sitting there for nearly 100 years.
Yes.
You now have a development which is adds value, and even with whatever adjustment the Giplet brings to it, the value and the revenue that we're going to receive post-development,
yes,
far exceeds what is being derived there now and will be derived for the foreseeable future, simply because this is vacant land that's been sitting there for 100 years.
That's correct. And specifically on the Mesa Public Schools, they currently get on those five parcels about $20,000. And how I figured that out, I just went to Maricopa County Assessor page and read all the totals and obviously added them up to about $20,000. With the Giplet revenue, we're estimating that the Mesa Public Schools will get approximately $240,000. So there's a huge advantage.
So it's
by developing
it's accomplishing its purpose.
Yes.
It's increasing the value of the land. It's increasing
exactly
that. So
Yeah, and it's our opinion that without this incentive, we would not have been able to locate Crescent to the city of Mesa. We were competing with a number of nearby cities as Crescent Crown was looking at various sites to relocate their facility.
I guess I just had one last question. Do you require a liquor license for this location for any reason?
Okay. We have it. We do. It's not a retail.
Will City Edge help their finances?
Well, yeah, I'm just curious.
No. There are approximately 450 employees at this site is what
correct.
I read. Did anyone do like a indirect economic analysis of those added employees in that area to like, you know, now obviously they have to eat lunch somewhere and they're going to shop at Riverview and Fiesta Mall on the way home and those kind of things. Did
Councilmember Higgins and council members, that's what I was referring to in that economic analysis that Mr. Fackler did. Right. It takes into account that. Now, one of the things that his analysis did not take into account is what's called the multiplier effect. A lot of times you can say that those number of jobs will also have a multiplier of X amount. Mm-hmm. That X amount is always debated. And so the report shows that it's not necessary to even go that route, that the benefits that we are receiving, that the community is receiving, far outweigh their benefits.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm ecstatic that Crescent Crown has chosen to really, and I've said this before, come back home to Mesa. Many people don't realize that Crescent Crown entered the market with the acquisition of Pearson Sons,
right.
who for many, many years was headquartered here in Mesa, right down the street on Main Street. And so we in many ways, we feel like you're coming home. Great addition to the area, great addition to the city. And from the renderings of that building, that would be a beautiful building regardless of where it went. And I think it would be a good addition to our city. So I'm happy with the fact that this site was not selected because you could come in and do something cheap. It's obvious that you take pride in the investment and that the investment is a full-blown investment. We're just anxious to wrap up some of the details and get going. So we appreciate your investment in our city, your city, your home city.
Well, Mayor and Council, we're happy to be here. We're excited about the project. And we're particularly excited with all the work that the staff here has done. They've been first rate since day one, and we've got a very accelerated schedule, and they're working very well with us on that.
Well, good. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And welcome. Okay, the next item is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on proposed amendments to ordinance regarding medical marijuana dispensaries and associated facilities.
They're good people.
Yeah. That's probably the one downside of Crescent Crown is they're taking up a perfect location for either a medical marijuana dispensary or a fireworks tent.
we need more.
We do need more. We certainly lacked them. Didn't have enough. Mr. Sheffield.
Mayor. I've been telling folks I've been working with this so long, I'm getting a contact munchie. So, we met with you folks in December and had this discussion. Based on that particular meeting, we were left with a few issues to resolve. We went back and took a look at those. Basically, there are three questions we have left to prepare before we before we do the introduction of the ordinance. One of them has to do with the actual eligibility of the districts. The direction that we had was definitely that you would like to see these in the industrial districts rather than in the commercial districts. The one question we had is whether or not the C3 district was still part of that or not. We're also, you asked us to take a look at the distribution of these, particularly with regard to the separation from some other uses, whether or not we could sit here and open up some additional industrial areas for this. We took a look at that, and what we're recommending is a reduction of the separation from parks and HOA open spaces. You've got maps that show you that. In addition to that, we've heard from the industry folks, and in particular, in order to meet demand, they're recommending that we increase the size of the cultivation facilities from the 3,000 square foot maximum that we currently have in the ordinance. They're recommending that because if we have a 3,000 square foot maximum, they would require several cultivation facilities as opposed to one or fewer larger facility. So we'll talk about that.
Well, Gordon, on that, and I guess you're going to get to it, but wouldn't the expansion in industrial areas, wouldn't that almost necessitate a change in that? Because if they go into these storefront warehouses, the warehouses are larger than the 3,000 square feet.
Typically, yes.
Okay. I just want to, I hadn't thought of that. But it seems like we, if we expand to the M1, M2, in a sense, we almost have to expand that area because that's the general size of the buildings are larger than 3,000 square feet. And the idea is to get the cultivation and the retail at the same place.
That's true, Mayor. On a practical basis, more of those spaces in the industrial areas are going to be larger than 1,500 or 3,000.
All right.
I have the Prop 203 information up just in case you're interested in that. I can go through it very, very quickly, or I'll just kind of skip over it unless that's necessary. But again, we're talking about the Department of Health Services issuing certifications for people to use medical marijuana on a medical basis to relieve some sort of debilitating condition. They're qualifying patients. They can obtain up to 2.5 ounces of marijuana every 2 weeks. The DHS ID cards expire after 1 year. They may be renewed. People under 18 require their parents' consent. The dispensaries are, there's one of these dispensaries for every 10 pharmacies in Arizona. DHS is estimating approximately 120 of these. Off-site cultivation is permitted. If there's not a dispensary within 25 miles of your residence, then you can grow your own, which is a concern. Dispensaries cannot be located within 500 feet of a K-12 school. And marijuana is not to be used on the dispensary property itself. You have to purchase it and then go someplace else.
But, Gordon, just so we clarify, I know that 25 miles is a concern for a lot of people. But if we have one dispensary in Mesa or even one in Gilbert, that would not be allowed in the entire city of Mesa, correct?
That's true. You either one or
one
two,
depending
upon where they're located.
Well, you don't have 25 miles from Gilbert right. to any part of Mesa. It's within the 25 miles.
But if you had for example, up in Las Sendas, it would be, you'd be right at the edge if you were down near Queen Creek. I mean, depending upon where they're located, but it's
if yeah. you were down near Queen Creek.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, if Mesa. This probably won't apply to our city. Those in the rural areas, this would certainly yes. apply. But anywhere in the Phoenix metro area, you look at 25 miles.
Once the dispensaries start being located, it's very yeah. likely that this won't apply.
Okay.
The cities may enact reasonable zoning regulations. That's why we're here. I have to correct the date on this. It's not when they send me the information. It's actually when they issue the information, which was December 17th. DHS anticipates having the regulations in place by March 28th, and they're strongly recommending that we have our zoning regulations in place and in effect by the time that they pass their regulations. The timing has been this. We have gone to the Planning and Zoning Board. We've talked to you about this on January 9th. We're talking to you again today. If the council is satisfied with once that we have some direction, we could introduce this coming Monday on January 10th. If you want us to work on this a little bit more, we'd probably have to introduce on January 24th. The council consideration, if we introduce on the 10th, would be the 24th. The effective date would be February 23rd. However, you can see if we bump this up too long, we're really cutting it close in terms of when the effective date of the ordinance would be relative to when DHS is anticipating passing their rules on March 28th. The Arizona League of Cities and Towns developed a model ordinance. Other cities have adopted their zoning amendments, including Phoenix and Tucson. Other cities in the area are scheduled to hear this in January. Most cities have used the commercial district. Gilbert is an exception to that. They are recommending the use, or their council is looking at their industrial zones also. Everybody is using spacing from protected uses, including schools and other facilities, but these spacing distance vary considerably.
Excuse me. Councilmember Higgins.
Yeah, just Gordon, have you, a couple other cities already have passed ordinances?
Yes.
Are they similar to this? Are there more spaces? I kind of heard chatting with someone from Phoenix. They were looking at a mile between locations.
Yes. In fact, Phoenix had initially proposed a half mile between facilities. They changed that to a mile. The Mesa proposals had also started out at a half mile between facilities. The Planning and Zoning Board recommended a mile distance as well. And that's the same proposal that's before you now.
So it's a mile between facilities.
Between dispensaries, yes.
Right, but all the other ones are between other things.
Right.
We're looking at.
Right. I'll get to the separations here. We're proposing a half mile from the rehabilitation type facilities, roughly just under a quarter mile from churches, parks, libraries, and schools, and then 500 feet from daycare and preschools. Part of this has, once we get to the maps, we're also taking a look at the possibility of reducing the separation from parks and HOA-maintained open spaces from 1,200 feet to 500 feet. And that has to do mainly with opening up some of the industrial areas, especially along the arterial streets.
I'm sorry. Is there any way we can come and, like, change that later? I'm sure we can. Like, start off with the one, and if we really find out there's no place to put something, come back and reduce that?
Sure. I mean, yeah, it's easier to reduce the separations than it is to increase them. But, yes, that's certainly an option of the council to do that if they choose to. We took a look at the separation requirements. In terms of, there are other facilities to consider besides the dispensaries, including cultivation facilities and what we're calling infusion facilities. An infusion facility is basically, in addition to actually inhaling the marijuana, there are folks who would prefer to ingest it, like in brownies or cookies or things like that. There are people also develop products where you can, the major chemical in marijuana can be absorbed through your skin, like a tongue strip or a skin strip, a transdermal patch. And so those are basically manufacturing types of activities, and those are called infusion sites. Those have been recommended for C3, M1, and M2. Again, similar separations, 1,200 feet from churches and schools, parks, and libraries. We have some caps on these facilities. And we do have this 3,000 square foot cultivation, our square foot gross floor area for maximum space for the cultivation facilities. That is an issue with the industry. Some additional things that have to do with concerns about the amount of marijuana that we kept on site with the dispensaries. The recommendation is 2,500 square feet for the dispensaries. Storage will be limited to 500 square feet. There would be an adequate area set aside for customer floor area, and it would be done in a permanent building. This would not be allowed to be housed in a trailer or an RV or something along that line. Similar types of requirements for the off-site cultivation, and then a cap on the amount of storage you could have for the patient caregiver cultivation sites at 250 square feet. When we met with you on December 9th, you had told us to drop the C2 district. We were unsure about C3, but definitely M1 and M2. So that's one of the questions that we had was, should we still include C3 as part of this, as part of these eligibility for districts? We're also taking a look at what happens if we reduce the separation from parks and HOA spaces from 1,200 feet to 500 feet. You can see that in the maps. The first map we have, and it's labeled map 1 at the top of the top right for the maps that I handed out this morning. If we just have C3 with these standard separations from the schools and others, but keep the 1,200-foot parks and HOA open spaces, this is C3 alone, not M1 and M2, this particular map. You can see there's really only three areas in the city where you could possibly put these. There's a small strip of land along Main Street, primarily between Stapley over to about, I think that's Gilbert Road, the Riverview area up into the far northwest, but that's primarily car lots for the most part, and that's why that's zone C3. Then you have the C3 that's along Country Club Drive, primarily south of US 60, down to the Chandler border. If we reduce that from 1,200 feet to 500 feet for the C3 district, You have the same three areas, only the area along Main Street expands east and west quite a bit. You also add the area along Broadway Road, primarily from Alma School to Price Road. Would that area would also open up?
Gordon, Councilmember Higgins has a question.
Just really, with when you circle that, you're just trying to highlight. You're not saying all that area. You're just showing the red dots within your circle.
I'm trying to bring attention to the red in that area.
All right, thanks.
No, not the entire area in the oval. No.
All right. Fair question.
If we take a look at the M1 district and we keep the 1,200-foot separation from M1 and M2, again, we have the there. You can see the quite a bit of the area of the city would be ineligible for a medical marijuana dispensary. Primarily, you have a little bit of area that's along Baseline Road between Country Club and Stapley. You have the shopping center where the Walmart's at Greenfield and US 60. Area along Elliott Road along the north side between Power Road onto about Signal Butte, and then the area around Falcon Field into the north toward Loop 202. If we reduce that to 500 feet from parks and HOA open spaces, again, it opens up Broadway Road along the north side. It opens up more of the corridor along Baseline between Country Club and Stapley, more of the area around Greenfield and US 60. It opens up the Superstition Springs industrial area near Sossaman Road, the industrial park that is south of Falcon Field along McKellops between Greenfield and Higley, as well as the areas that are to the southeast toward Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport.
Just out of curiosity, that area south of Falcon Field, if you reduce that to 500 feet, it has to be X amount of feet from a school.
Correct.
So that overrides the fact that there might be a park there, right?
Right. Right. It still have to be a quarter mile from the Barbara Bush Elementary School in that particular.
And you would still be able to do something in there?
Yeah, because once you get roughly a quarter mile away from the school, you still have about a half mile between, 48th Street over to.
That would basically open up all the areas, to the east, up to Higley, or.
Well, to the west, right.
To the west, to the west, not to the east, you're right. It would close up the ones to the east, but to the west it would open those up.
That's correct.
Okay.
And then the last two maps basically show the combination. It shows if you were to take C3, M1, and M2, and use the 1,200-foot separation requirement, you have those same M1, M2 corridors. You still have those C3 areas along Main Street and along Country Club. And then if we reduce that to 500 feet from parks and HOA open spaces, it really opens up Main Street in particular and the area on the north side of Broadway between Country Club and Price. So those are basically our options.
Well, looking at your maps, it seems like, you know, we've once again, the law requires that we have reasonable reasonable zoning regulations. If we got an interplay here between not only the separation from HOA or open spaces, but also the mile separation. And it seems like on one of the maps, those two sort of or run into each other because you have big areas, but for example, between Mesa Drive and Stapley on a 1,200 foot separation, you could only put one in there anyway.
Correct.
And because of the interaction between the 1,200 foot separation and the mile between dispensaries.
Right.
You know, I'm wondering whether if we restrict too much, whether we run into that reasonableness thing where, you have all these great separations, but the way that they mix together, you've almost precluded locations in a large swatch of the city, regardless of what your maps say.
That's one of the reasons, Mayor, why we took a look at the separation from parks and HOA spaces and reducing that to 500 feet. So that, for example, if we put one at the corner of Country Club and Baseline, for example, that would, for the most part, that would be everything from Alma School to Mesa Drive. So that's quite a bit of that area that's basically shown.
Yeah, because it's a mile each way.
Right. And
so it's really, it's a 2 mile. The mile separation really creates a 2 mile area where you'd only have one dispensary.
Correct.
Because it's a mile each way. Well, I'm sorry? Yeah. Can we do, Councilman Harrigan says, can we do this with pharmacies? Go ahead.
It's unlikely that we'd be able to do that.
That was a joke, Gordon.
Okay.
I know it's early in the morning. I know that was a bad joke, but it was still humor. Okay.
Pardon.
Councilman Finter.
I think it's a reasonable way to go drop to 500. We kind of moved away from the commercial facilities to an industrial type of setting. So to me, it would seem reasonable, drop to 500. And then I know we need to have a discussion about actual cultivation facilities. On the surface, if the argument is we can have a lot of little ones or some larger, less larger ones, it might be reasonable to think that less is better, but just have them a little larger facility. I don't know what that square footage is, so that's the way I'm thinking.
Well, I think one of the reasons to go more of industrial is you could combine the two. You could have, like, because we have a lot of our, we talk industrial, but really a lot of our industrial is the light industrial, which is, I call storefront warehouse. You know, you either have an office or even retail operations running out of an M1 district where you have storage and manufacturing production in the back in a warehouse. And you know, the hopes is maybe you can combine those two so that they're you don't have the multiple locations. You can do that.
I think that's exactly the context we find in Mesa, yes.
You know how they're – and now I guess since they have to be – we have different regulations – we would limit the amount if they went into a storefront warehouse. Would measure the dispensary size as the front of the house, and then the cultivation would be the warehouse part of it.
That's correct, Mayor. Yes.
Okay, so there'd be two separate calculations, but in one location, in one physical location. Now the 10,000.
The separations don't apply when the cultivation facility relates directly to that dispensary.
Right. Now, question I have, P&Z came up with 10,000. You're recommending going to 12,000 for the warehouse. Am I hearing that correctly?
12,000 or even basically maybe drop the limitation entirely for the cultivation facility.
Yeah, because isn't that sort of self-limiting based on?
Exactly. In fact, I'm not sure if Chief made the
here. We have back there.
We had a conversation with the police department about this yesterday, and my understanding from them is they would much rather look at fewer, larger,
sort of like what Councilmember Fender's talking about.
Fewer larger facilities rather than multiple smaller facilities.
I mean, as long as the standards are maintained, whether it's 6,000 or 16,000 doesn't seem to really matter.
Correct.
I mean, if you have security in place, if you have those kind of things that would relate to what the police department cares about, I can see having fewer but larger.
And Mayor, can I?
Yeah.
That may lead us to a conversation a little bit later this month when we bring back the SEPTED that we made.
I was going to say, can we have marijuana SEPTED?
Sure. Absolutely.
Sure.
Okay.
We should.
No, but I think the police department may come and say we may want to include
some security
securities
measures.
Securities as we look at that, including the dispensaries as part of that.
And I would guess that's probably an easy discussion. I've only talked to a couple in the industry, and it seems like it's in their best interest, and they go overboard in trying to do this. So that, I'm hoping that's a much easier discussion than it has been with in the past. Councilman Higgins.
Mayor, when we moved down to that 500-foot separation, it kind of works in most of the city except the newer parts where we put schools and industrial zones and parks and industrial zones. So the real problem I have when we do that is the area, you know, where around Barbara Bush Elementary School, which we built in an industrial, we didn't build, but we allowed to be built in an industrial area, and Quail Run and the big Quail Run Park. When we go down to 500 feet, you know, that just really, that makes those two spots vulnerable. But nowhere else.
Vulnerable? Doesn't the separation from the school, that trumps?
Yeah, but it's still not far enough. When you look at the two different maps, I mean, there's not a school other than Barbara Bush that would be anywhere near something like this when you look at the rest of the map.
Correct.
Pretty close, right? Because we don't...
With the exception of charter schools.
Yes. So with that and the Quail Run, which, again, we built in an industrial park, everything else would not have that same problem. So when we go down, those are the two areas on the whole map that if we went to 500 feet, I have issues with because they're just too close. Because, yes, the 1,200 foot, you know what I'm saying, typically schools are in neighborhoods. They're buffered by the neighborhood. But in this case, Robert Bush is an industrial park. So it doesn't have the same neighborhood buffer that every other school in Mesa has. I mean, we could go look, and I bet you I'd win right there.
Well, I mean, I may be getting too philosophical, but what's the logic behind the separation from a school and one of these dispensaries?
Part of it's to limit the interactions between the folks.
Okay, what's the interaction?
Folks who would be going to purchase the marijuana. It's a recommendation that comes from the chiefs. The police chief.
I'm trying to understand. I mean, I'm sort of asking a the question, but it's really not. Because I'm trying to figure out, if you take it on its face value, and these are truly medical uses, because if you're talking about all the bad things that are going to happen, then you're assuming that the basic pretext is wrong, that these are not medical uses, that someone's either going and buying for resale or buying for use or buying for whatever. But if you go by the pretext, this is medical use, then what difference does it make if it's 500 feet or 1,200 feet?
The basic concern with the activity has to do with burglaries, robberies, and loitering. Are the three primary bad things that might happen around.
So it's going to be less of a chance of burglarized if it's, or we don't want a burglary going on that close to a school?
You want to keep the school separated from that activity.
Okay. In case there's a daytime burglary and someone goes in to rob it, it's better that take place further away from a school. Okay, Chief?
I just want to confirm that the separation is to, because it the history has shown that it will cause some crime. And even though we know that on face value it's for medical uses, there are going to be those that are going to abuse that. So I think what you're talking about is the white paper from the chiefs of police in California. They're recommending that separation just to keep that element away from the schools.
Now, the difference between, and I'm just, so we don't just jump in to have a knee-jerk reaction. The difference between what we're requiring in Arizona with only having one per mile, you know, our separation and our requirements are much different from what I understand than they are in California. California is more of a free-for-all than Arizona is. At least that's what it's been sold as. Right. And I got to take it at face value that with the restrictions we have. Does that affect or change or impact the separation requirements?
The separation requirements are designed to do, they're, at least from my standpoint, they're designed to do the two things. One is to limit the interaction that you might have with these potential crimes that might take place at the dispensaries. In addition to that, you're also looking at the balance of whole of what are the eligible sites that are taking place on a whole basis, holistic basis for the whole city. Once you take certain separations and place them together, what are you left with in terms of eligible sites for the locations of potential dispensaries? Are those generally areas where you want the dispensaries to be, or are those locations basically that you want to totally discourage from even potentially locating? And that's kind of what
The most powerful one is the mile separation.
Yes.
Because that in and of itself has a tendency to almost limit. You have one site and then all of a sudden that entire area, you know, for literally, well, that, if you have one in the middle, basically for four square miles, you have excluded any other site. That's what a mile separation does for you. Is it shuts down four square miles? If I'm doing my math right.
Potentially, yes. You could put, for example, if you put
Why just potentially? Isn't it a math?
I was just going to say, for example, if you put one on the northwest corner of Alma School and Baseline,
you got a mile each way, north, south, east, west.
You could put one on the northeast corner of Country Club and Baseline.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that would, in essence, they would still be a mile apart, but they
would
have
overlap. That's what I mean. But you've got within that mile.
Correct.
You can have nothing.
Yes.
So it's not square. I know. It's.
Yeah. Okay. But, I mean the
four round miles.
But I guess the point I was trying to make is the separations can overlap. The separation for one can overlap the other one. So it's not necessarily that's not the edges of the separations. so you end up being 2 miles apart. The 1 mile.
No, I get that. But you have mile each way, east, west, north, south. Northwest, southwest, that's
all of that.
Get around. Okay, so, I mean, isn't that, doesn't that, to me, that's the most powerful thing that limits clustering. And it seems like we have real problems when we have clustering, when we have things like that. Doesn't it create an easier, and I'm asking the chief, would it create an easier control if you have single locations that aren't, you get away from the clustering that we've got from other types of uses, or does that not really matter? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out.
I would say trying to avoid clustering would be beneficial.
And that's one thing we're doing here that I know that in California, my understanding, I may be wrong on this, they do have clustering because they don't have some of the restrictions we have or are proposing with our zoning.
The biggest difference between what happened in California or Colorado and what's happening in Arizona is that the Arizona cities and counties are being allowed to get their zoning in place before the DHS starts issuing licensing. And so you don't get that grandfathering effect where you get a rush that comes in and you haven't had a chance to study the issue and create adequate separations, and you get that kind of clustering activity.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there any way that we can take care of it? There's a couple of extraordinary situations where we have, like, an elementary school that's in an industrial area that seems to run counter to what we're trying to accomplish here. Because for 99% of the city, it seems like just by making that rule, we have conformed with what normally happens. Mm-hmm. You have an elementary school in a neighborhood, you have the natural bufferings, you have those kind of things. But, you know, other than Barbara Bush, and then, of course, charter schools. Mm-hmm. Do we have charter schools in industrial areas or in C3 areas?
Matt, we've tried to, based on the Department of Education list of schools that are in Mesa, it's all schools, private schools, charter schools, public schools, we've taken that into account in the maps that you've seen.
Okay.
So that we think that the information on the maps is as up to date as we understand that information to be. So the areas that are not in gray on the maps would be the areas that we believe would be eligible. So that it does include charter schools, does include private schools.
I guess what I'm getting at is I would rather than focusing on the one exception, if we could have a general rule, is there a way that we could maybe deal with the exception while not sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater?
I've got an idea, but I need to vet it through attorneys first.
I mean, because we tend to, and this is normal in our process, we tend to deal with the exceptions.
Yeah.
Right.
And obsess with those. I'd like to get something where we can come up with a general rule that basically covers what we see on an everyday basis, and is if there's a way we can deal with the exception.
Mayor, Donna? If I may, Donna Bronski from the City Attorney's Office. Certainly, if you wanted to adopt a rule that had a special separation from schools in industrial areas, that would handle it, and I think it would address your concerns.
I'm seeing, let's do that. But once again, let's don't obsess over it. Let's just recognize that, we know it happens in one particular instance with Barbara Bush. It could happen with a charter school that comes up that isn't there yet and goes into an industrial area. If we could come up with just something that deals with those exceptions. And I think we all like the general approach and what we see, but let's deal with those exceptions.
Yeah, can we include those parks in the industrial area too? I think that picks up maybe two other smaller areas.
A park or a school, we could run under the same type of rule.
And have we thought of the county islands that are out in the east and the fact that we're just talking about the city of Mesa separation? We can get something in the county island across the street from one. Is that not true?
The language in the ordinance that's been prepared takes into account, does not... The separations are not limited to those things that are in the city. They also include those things that are outside the jurisdiction of Mesa.
Really?
So if there was a charter school in Gilbert, for example, that would affect the separation for a local.
Or if there were a store in a county island, you would have that mile would go from that store, regardless of which jurisdiction it's in.
But we might do that, but is the county going to follow our and say, oh, Mesa has a store on Power McDowell, so we can't put one at...
Well, we're establishing procedures with Maricopa County so that when we get the zoning clearance from DHS, basically we will have contacted both any of the neighboring jurisdictions to to find out where locations are, and then we'll take those into account.
So do you think they're going to work with us and not end up with clustering out there in our...
It is my sincere hope that they do. I intend to work with them as well.
Okay, great.
Well, then once again, I think DHS has at least in their proposed... listening to Director Humble, he said they were going to try to go with a proportional distribution. Is that what the... I haven't read the draft of the proposal.
That's my understanding as well.
Okay, so it's going to be population-based without regard to... You're going to go to a general area, and they're going to assign based on areas. So that's sort of a self-limiting in and of itself. Okay.
So
Councilmember Fender asked about square footage for cultivation. Do you recommend no limits?
Yes, we drop the limits on cultivation.
All right. Okay. All right. Councilmember Richens.
I just want to confirm the types of development that are in C3. Is like the Mesa Grand development at Stapley and Baseline a C3 or is that a C2?
The Mesa Grand at Stapley and Baseline is actually an M1 with a council use permit.
Oh, okay. So,
but that's is that an example of what a C3 would be, though? I mean, I know it's not a C3.
It's typical C3 development you'll find along Country Club and along Main Street. It's rare outside of those particular strips simply because the council didn't really like the uses that were in the C3 district. For the most part, C3 is outdoor commercial uses. It would be things like car lots, plant nurseries. It tends to be kind of quasi-commercial industrial activities like welding shops, body shops. It tends to be facilitation or fabrication types of activities, cabinet making shops, things like that tend to be what are typical C3 uses.
But they're mostly found along Country Club and Main Street. Anywhere else in the city?
There are a few spots. If we go back to the map, that's just C3, which is map 1. The area along Riverview, again, car lots in the Riverview area are zoned
C3. Superstition Springs Mall. Is that a C2 or C3? Or
what's that?
What would that be? A mall like Superstition Springs.
Typically C2.
That'd be C2.
Correct.
And centers, normally C2?
No, normally C2. Occasionally, especially some of the Walmart sites are zoned M1 with a council use permit.
Okay.
I'm having a hard time getting comfortable with C3 being included in this at all. I'd like to just limit it to M1 and M2.
I'm good with that. Hang on. Mayor,
go ahead.
My concern, when we look at that map and put the C3, which is the little red area, right? Mm-hmm. We honestly could have every mile. I know there's a mile, like Gordon said, you could on one corner, it could be on one side of the street and the other, right? And you could end up with it all the way down Main Street. We could have all 8 of them for the whole city located on Main Street, where our light rail and our economic development corridor, and we'll have our medical marijuana dispensaries every mile. I don't know if that's something we want. And, you know, we do have to look long term. I don't know. Throwing that out there for y'all. I don't know.
I'm really indifferent. I think as long as we provide adequate accessibility, I think that most of the M1 areas we're looking at that will bring these are really more like I said, the storefront warehouse that provide adequate exposure to arterials. You know, they're not, and contrary to certain reports, this is not an idea to hide them back in the corner of an industrial area. Number one, I don't think the market's going to do that. We have plenty of light industrial places which have frontage to our arterial streets, which have like officer or quasi-retail storefronts. And I think that's the kind of place that these will go to, which have a warehouse in the back that could create cultivation areas, and it would seem like it would be more efficient, and also provides the security that we're looking at because they do have exposure. This isn't an idea to hide these things. They're going to come. They're legal, no matter what we think about them. I like the fact that they're in all quadrants of the city, even with M1, M2. There are places where these businesses can locate that can be
easily accessible to citizens. If we can accomplish that within 1M2, I don't really care. I don't have a problem with them being in C2, frankly, because you look at 140 square miles and you have 8 stores, and those are going to get lost, I think, anyway. And I think that, I drive around California. I drove around Colorado. We drove past these things. You don't even notice them. So I'm not going to say there's not going to be any problems, but I think with the separation we have, with the fact that they are limited to, based on our population, to probably 8 to 10, I think we're going to be able to easily handle these, and the market will take care of it, and it'll be just fine, regardless whether we have C3 or not.
So.
How about if can I make a recommendation? Sure, I can. I can do anything I want. I'm kind of hearing you, and I kind of like that M1, M2 only. But I'd like to start off with M1, M2, and the 1,200 feet from parks and HOA open spaces, and see what happens. If all of a sudden we're getting sued because no one has any open space, then we can revisit it. But that's where I'd like to start, because we can always get stricter.
Stricter or less restrictive?
No,
that would be
stricter. I would like to go with the M1, M2 with the 1,200 foot separation, which would be.
It'll be map 3.
Map 3. That's. And if we want to go to 500 foot, open it up more, we want to add C3 someday, we can do that. It's a starting spot. And I don't you think it's enough space that they wouldn't say, oh, you're being too restrictive and not. Because. I mean, if you look at the blue on this map, there's plenty of spaces within the city.
I'm not going to attempt to speak for the industry on that.
Sure, come on.
Well,
that's where I'm going with that.
The challenge I have with that, and I understand where you're coming from, is that what I look at is these dark spaces, you do now push them back into the back parts of the industrial areas. Because if you look at it, even those spaces you're talking about, most of the frontage is now eliminated. So if you're going to take away C3, mm-hmm. Then you are going to push them back in the areas, and I think we're creating problems that we want to avoid, which is the police department. I don't know that you'd be that excited about having these things.
Well, we can't enforce the law in the back of an industrial zone.
Yeah.
Well, I think that once again.
I hope so.
No, I think we can, but I'm just going by what the police department says, is that one of the issues they had was it's easier because you now have a whole different set of eyes if it has visibility. I mean, isn't that a standard? Boy, I'm really putting you on the spot now.
Well, if we've
just going by what I heard is that they would like them to be as visible as possible, so that the increased visibility somehow lowers the propensity for crime. If they are hidden back, yes, you can enforce it, but it increases the.
You're correct. In generalities, yes. If things are out visible, then they're easy for us to monitor. Our recommendation is not either way on that aspect. We're probably going to make some recommendations on just the safety and security of the facilities. But
yeah, I have less concern about the 500 versus 1,200 foot than I do about.
Well, that's me.
Allowing so much on Main Street potentially with the C3. That's something I want to see, because all the C3 is in the west side, and so you end up getting too much.
And so what you're saying is that because C3 was a zoning category that was used in bygone eras, by default it throws it into the. It's not because of the land use; it's because that was the designation that was used during that period of time.
Right, right.
And so it's just by accident. A C3 designation we would never give C3 to right now.
Right.
Okay.
And so, gotcha. I mean, the 1,200 foot, 500 foot, I mean, that to me, it's not as big a deal. I mean, I could live with
And I'm with you
feet.
On that.
I could live with 0 feet. I mean, it's just.
It's not, I would feel more comfortable with 500 feet.
But if I can get rid of C3, I could shrink the separation and feel comfortable that we've provided a reasonable zoning category.
As long as Councilmember Richens realizes that the C3 goes all the way to Power Road. And doesn't just say West Mesa, I would agree with him.
Yeah, but I think
that, it's that older.
I think the situation
the C3
is the same.
Does, but not the the eligible uses. I mean, there's not very many.
Well, I think the issue is the same is that it focuses on Main Street.
Yes,
and it's not so much that it focuses on Main Street, but what we're saying is that we're choosing a zoning category that we really don't use.
And we have C2 uses along Main Street simply because of the history of the zoning. Am I repeating that correctly?
Yeah, C3 authorizes C2 uses as well.
Well, I understand the technical. What I'm saying is that why do we have C3 along Main Street? That's because Main Street is different than Southern?
Because Maricopa County's Board of Supervisors established along federal and state highways in the 1950s.
There you go. So what we're saying is that there's no real reason to say, oh, C3 is a great area, is a great designation to put these, because what we say is along Main Street, we have areas, long stretches of road that are zone C3 that we would never zone C3 right now because they're C2 uses. And how we would approach things would be on a C2 basis. Whereas on Southern, you don't have that. And I think that creates problems, that simply because of an accident of history or of what you called it at a certain time 50 years ago, that now that is somehow eligible and it's not, because it creates a disproportionate clustering by default. And I would agree with that. If we're going to go with C3, then we might as well go back to the C2, C3, and at least make it consistent. But if we're not going to do that, then I have no problem with the M1, M2, as long as I feel more comfortable with the 500-foot separation. I think that's good enough. Okay?
Vice Mayor?
Okay. So I think you've got your
orders. There's a couple of things we want to get clarified, though.
Okay.
So we're going.
Sorry.
You're on.
M1 and M2.
M1, M2.
With the 500-foot separation.
Right.
And then there was a comment about unlimited maximums on the cultivation.
On the cultivation.
Versus having some cap, or do you just... that sounds like... could we not become the...
Aren't the regulations... Before we say unlimited cap, I think we're going with the understanding that the cultivation is used only for that store.
We could... The number that I've seen that came out of a report related to Tucson experience was 25,000 square feet. I think there's an email attachment in the report. Basically, they took a look at Tucson's population is roughly about 518,000. They estimate roughly 20,000 patients coming from that population. From that, they said that they would need roughly 120 cultivation facilities if the cap remained in Tucson at 3,000 square feet. The number of cultivation facilities would reduce down to about 15 if the facility size went up to 25,000 square feet. So 25,000, if we could use 25,000 as a cap, we could get a similar experience.
Yeah, Councilmember Richens.
Why don't we just do this? Why don't we look at the potential M1, M2 product that we have and see what the square footages are that are attached to the product that we have? And say, you know, if what we have are these flex industrial with the retail in the front and each of the warehouses, the biggest warehouse we possibly have in our market is 10,000 feet, then match it to that and call it good.
I think when we answer that, the biggest warehouse we have is like 100,000 square feet or more.
In these zoning categories?
Yeah. Because you go to M2, Broadway 101, for example, is M1. They got buildings that are 100,000 square feet. You got down by.
So is the notion true that only one cultivation facility feeds one dispensary, or can all the dispensaries in Mesa, for example,
or outside of Mesa? And I think that's the issue. That's the question. If you go to unlimited, could we create a gigantic distribution center that sells? My understanding is that. And just talking to some people in California who are actually in the industry, I wasn't a patient or anything. They're talking about that you think that individual store owners cultivate their own, and apparently that's not what happens. Apparently you have almost dual industries where certain people cultivate and sell to dispensaries.
Typically a dispensary is associated with a particular cultivation site. So there's a link there. But one cultivation facility may have more than one link to more than one dispensary.
Yeah, I have a friend who's, and it was interesting because his father-in-law is involved in the industry in California. He was had terrible cancer 10, 15 years ago or whatever it was, started using it and then went into the industry. And he talked about certain groups who have then created these cultivation things and sell to multiple dispensaries. And, you know, it's just like a...
So they have a variety of products to sell.
Yeah, and they'll service many multiple, just like you know, just like you do in any regular manufacturing, who then sells to the retail areas. And I would assume that because of efficiencies and quality, they say, you know, because certain cultivators develop reputations for quality and those kind of things, and therefore dispensaries start buying from different growers. So the market sort of defines how that is. I would like to put a cap on it that is a reasonable cap, and if somebody wants to come in for more than that, they can come in and talk to us about it. Okay. Whether it's 15, 20,000 feet.
Yeah, you had 12 to 25,000. Can you go to 20,000?
And I think we're saying that 12,000 is too small, or?
The information that's been given to me is their preference is 25,000.
Okay.
I don't
have a problem with that.
The only other question that we had then, and it kind of came up during the conversation, did you want a larger separation than from parks in industrial districts or schools in industrial districts?
We wanted to come up with some special, whether it be a use permit or something that allows us to deal with the exceptions. Well, I don't know if you can.
Set up a use permit process?
No.
Or maybe we just do a greater separation from greater schools
separation
and industrial
if, yeah.
areas.
Whatever's easiest and creates an objective standard. I don't want to be having multiple
so we'll have
requests
have
coming
separate,
here and fighting that fight.
For those.
Okay. So if there is a school that's in M1, there's maybe different separations.
And a city park also.
And a city park.
Okay. Okay. I think that clarified, right? Did we get all the outstanding issues? Right. Yeah.
What do we settle on for square footage?
I heard 25,000. 25,000. You want to do less?
Yeah.
Well, let's start with 25. 25 meets the standards of the industry. Let's start with that, if that's okay.
Okay. And so we'll make these changes. It won't make it on the agenda for Monday, but we will have it. We're just going to have plan and putting it on for the 24th. We'll have it. Obviously, to review it as part of a study session before then. But I think we're going to plan on getting on the 24th because that looked like we're getting pretty close to
correct.
The date where we need to have this adopted. Okay?
It's not the end of the world if we don't get it by the time the regs come out. But
The DHS director is really...
Well, I understand that, but let's do it right, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I guess
let's get it right.
Is
I'm not saying let's be lackadaisical about it.
Yeah.
But don't rush something just because, you know, 2 weeks is not going to... is not getting in the world. I'd rather do it right and not make a mistake.
I'm going to say after that, though.
Yeah, I understand that. So let's push for the 24th then. Okay?
Okay.
All righty. Besides, Mr. Glover was just dying to handle this as his first act. Right?
Wants to go on record.
Chris Glover's first vote. How do you feel on marijuana? Next item. Hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposed nuisance code changes. Hey, our first vote was to approve the budget that we hadn't really seen. So,
yeah, this is much different.
Yeah, it's easy. Ms. Albright.
Good morning, Mayor, Council.
Good morning.
In September, we went before the council to talk about some proposed changes to the nuisance code. At that time, we were asked to check into three additional issues. We have done that research, and today we're going to present some options, some staff recommendations, obtain final decision from you, and hope to prepare an ordinance for, I believe, your first meeting in February. The three issues we were asked to check into were to look at a process for additional inoperable or unregistered vehicles for a hobbyist. What is the cumulative effect of parking RVs, boats, and other vehicles on a single lot, and should we regulate yard sales? We laid this out one at a time, so do you want to provide direction as we go through, or you just talk about it all at the end? It's either way is fine with me.
Why don't you go ahead and go through the presentation. We'll bring up questions at the end.
The first thing we were asked to do is look at a permit process where a hobbyist could get additional vehicles, inoperable or unregistered vehicles. We did some benchmarking of the East Valley cities, and no other East Valley city has a process other than to modify their city code. So we've laid out two options here. Option A, which is staff recommendation, is to stay with limiting inoperable or unregistered vehicles to just two per lot that are not enclosed. That allows a hobbyist as many vehicles they want if they're in an enclosed structure. It still keeps them prohibited from the front yard. The second option, though, would be to have an annual zoning use permit where we would perform annual inspections to make sure they're screened from the right-of-way, free of trash, weeds, environmental hazards. This would involve a change to the zoning code. We would have to issue permits and inspect annually. It would require some additional resources. Because some of this could be in the backyard and not necessarily visible from the right-of-way, it could be difficult to inspect or enforce. The second option
can
is...
Can I ask a rhetorical question?
Sure.
If you can't see it from anywhere,
beyond the lot boundaries is what our typical... Our nuisance ordinance requires most things to be visible beyond the lot boundaries, so...
Okay. I guess my question is, other than maybe an unsafe situation...
Right.
Okay, that's what you're dealing with?
Right.
That's what you're referring to?
Yes.
Okay.
The second issue was to look at the cumulative effect of having RVs, boats, utility trailers, inoperable, unregistered vehicles on a single lot. Again, we benchmarked the other East Valley cities, and none of them deal with this issue. The RVs are regulated in the zoning code. The inoperable and boats and utility trailers are regulated in the nuisance code. Currently, RVs, boats, utility trailers all have location limitations. They have to be in the side or rear yard. We are proposing limiting the number of inoperable or unregistered vehicles. So we believe from a staff standpoint, those two, the limitation on the location, the limitation on the number, is kind of creates a natural limitation of how many of these things would be on any lot. So staff's recommendation is not to add any type of maximum number of vehicles to a lot. However, we've laid out another option, is we could limit any type of recreational vehicle, watercraft, utility trailer to no more than two inoperable or unregistered for a total of four vehicles. That would include some modifications to the zoning ordinance, and we would have to look at how to define the small off-road vehicles. Currently, canoes, jet skis are all defined as watercraft. So if a person had two jet skis and two canoes, they couldn't have an RV. So, and again, that could be very difficult to enforce.
Is this really a problem?
Do we have just a
groundswell of complaints from people that their neighbor has too many canoes in their backyard?
No, we do not.
Oh, okay.
But these were questions that we were asked to research.
No, I understand that.
The last issue was, should we regulate yard sales? We did. In our benchmarking, all of the other East Valley cities do regulate garage sales to 2 to 3 per year, with a maximum of like 3 days each. I believe there's a chart in your report that gives you the details. We do not regulate them right now. We have been working from a past interpretation where we allow up to 4 a year, 3 days each. Anything above that, we have said, has the potential to be a business operation. That has been very difficult to enforce in the past. So we've laid out 3 possible options here. One option is option A, to allow 12 per year, up to 3 days each. That's roughly one per month. Option B, continue to leave it unregulated and focus on the business activity. Again, that has been difficult in the past. Or option C, which is staff's recommendation, which is to allow up to 4 per year, a maximum of 3 days each. We feel that's consistent with the other communities, the interpretation we have been operating on in the past. I will note, though, in general, this has not been a major issue. There's just there's certain areas of the town that we receive complaints in the spring and the fall. But for the most part, it's a couple of neighborhoods throughout the city, and that's about it.
And are these complaints based on individual houses or people that seem to have recurring garage sales? Is that what the nature of the complaints are?
Yes. Okay. During the spring or the fall, they'll have them like every weekend
something.
And that is fairly prevalent in my neck of the woods. So we have homes that have made it a regular business, and they're not running a business, but yet they are.
Yeah.
And so we need to be able to give staff more definition on how they can handle that so that the interpretation is clear and people understand what the ordinance is.
Okay.
questions, comments on either one?
You want to start with the first one? And which issue one, which option or modification?
Yeah, I know we talked about this before, but what gave rise to this?
The inoperable.
And I know there's a couple of there were a couple of situations where there was basically a junkyard being operated out of a backyard.
We have about three properties in the city of Mesa that have several old vehicles in their backyard that they're not necessarily hobbyists. They're
junkyards.
Yeah.
And how big are these? Are these in rural areas, urban area? I mean, when I say rural, just like a Lehigh type of area or an East Mesa, or is this like in a normal neighborhood, they just cram it into their backyard?
Two of them are on areas that would exceed an acre. One of them is in a neighborhood.
Okay. So both yeah. situations.
Yeah, that I know of right now. Those are the ones we've received complaints of.
All right.
I've been working with the hobbyist industry quite a bit. We've been really promoting the classic car activities in Mesa, and my concern about this was threatening that industry when we've really created a positive environment for them to come and operate in, and so my concern has been that oftentimes when they're building a car, they'll have several hobbyist vehicles that they're working with. Can you go back to the slide that talks about the vehicle limits? And we've tried to work a little bit with industry to figure out what really works for them. And this, the unregistered vehicles and not enclosed and enclosed structure. I mean, usually the enclosed structure contains the car they're building, and then out in the backyard they'll have a couple of inoperable vehicles that they're scrapping parts off of. And so if we can accommodate that activity in a positive way, that's I think what we're trying to get to.
They would be, as proposed in the current ordinance right now, option A, they could have as many vehicles as they want in an enclosure, garage, detached garage, but no more than two parked cars outside.
I guess my question is if we have three exceptions or four exceptions in a city as large as ours, I'm wondering why we put any ordinance in that takes care of those three, but also limits 50 that are carrying on a hobby or whatever in a very responsible manner. And I feel a little bit uncomfortable making a law to handle the exception that then affects regular citizens that are doing a great job. And I don't know what that limit is. Where did you come up with the two?
That was consistent with some of the other East Valley cities. I believe it's Scottsdale requires everything indoors. Tempe and Chandler allows two outdoors. Gilbert's pretty much unregulated as long as it's screened. Our current code is unlimited as long as they're screened from the public view.
Councilmember Higgins?
I couldn't agree with you more because, I mean, we're a city of 500,000 and we have three instances where we have issues. And I've also had a lot of calls from the, car enthusiasts, and they say, sure, you have two parked cars per car, but they might be working on three classic cars. So that means if you got, you got six possible parked cars. And I don't think these people are operating in, like, R19 areas. They're, there's...
If you're working on three cars, you're a business. You're restoring classic cars, and you're are you driving three classic cars? They're going to sell those classic cars.
No, I'll tell you,
so
this
then
one guy
kind of
gave me a list and has been doing it for his whole life, in his 60s.
So what?
He has nine registered cars that he takes on different kinds of shows.
That he keeps on his property.
Yeah, obviously we've not had a complaint on his house, so they're all registered, they're parked, he's got enough room for them. And he takes them to, this is this classic car show. You take that to the, other things. I think it's great that we have people that have hobbies.
What's the kind of situation that arises if you have three? What's the difference of having four cars back there versus two cars back there? What's the thought process on that? It's just that two was consistent with what other people have done?
Yeah, it was just a number that we saw in other ordinances.
Trying to figure out, not knowing where to draw the line, right. Figuring, hey, other cities have done that.
Is there a public safety issue? Firefighters have to go fight a fire at a house that has inoperable vehicles on the side and rear yard. Is that an issue? Mary, is that an issue?
But we have that now because we allow people to park RVs right next to a to a house and to park boats. I mean, I'm more concerned about can you see, does it affect your neighbors? Can you see the activity? Does it create a safety hazard? And you know, if people are driving down the street and they have no idea what's going on in the backyard and it doesn't create a safety hazard, I'm trying to figure out why we should get involved.
Our current ordinance does not.
But on the other hand, I believe we should have something in there that if there is an egregious violation of standards, of normal standards, that we have something regulatory that gives our staff a hook to go in there and take care of something. And maybe it's not two cars, maybe it's some other kind of definition. Because I understand the frustration.
Yeah.
Most of the people are good, but then you have someone who's really out of bounds and the staff's frustration is we have nothing to go in there and take care of those exceptions.
Right.
Is that where we're, is that really where we are right now?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if we're helping or muddling this issue, but I was trying to think through it.
We don't have
someone down here.
Those three cases.
Councilmember Fender?
Well, I was just wondering, you know, not seeing from the front, a gate left open, RV gate, moving vehicles in and out regularly, so you can, as you drive by, you see a stack of cars down the side drive. I mean, do we have any provisions that address that, or a slatted gate that you can see through and obviously see there's something back there?
They would have to have, they could not have a slatted gate where you could see through, because then we could still see it from the right of way. We have had a couple of complaints where there's been a lot of cars, but we've been able to monitor it and determine it was business activity. So there was a lot of cars they were working on, but it was a business, and we were able to deal with it from that standpoint. Like I said, there's only a few I know where they just have a lot of cars in the backyard.
If what we're trying to get at is preventing people from having junkyards. I mean, you go back to the medical marijuana stuff, you know, let's worry less about the exception.
Yeah.
And just say, okay, if a junkyard is clearly different than a hobbyist. So how do we get
how do we
that?
Define that?
How do we
draw
how do
that
we define
line?
That?
That's the challenge. How do you define it?
They're working on a car before a certain date. Is there?
Well,
the
other problem,
cars are all of the same make and model. I mean,
the other problem is that four cars in an acre and a half lot is a lot different than two cars on a 7,000 square foot lot. I mean, you put two cars in the back of a R17 lot, and you know you're walking over the car to get the garbage cans out. You put two cars down in Lehigh, and you don't even notice it. It gets lost in the among all the farm animals that you've now got things.
The cows.
I mean, so how can you say how can you have one definition that applies to a wide variety of lot size? I don't know. Maybe we're
you do it by law.
And Mayor, I mean, I've seen some of the complaints that have come in from some council. I think Dennis has one specifically, and it's difficult because you could have three or four cars back there, and one perception, a neighbor's perception, is it's a junkyard, and the owner says, no, I'm working on them, but they haven't changed much in the last 5 years. So, and that's hard. It's hard to say, well, how much work are you doing on that as part of a hobby, or is it just really just sitting there? And it puts co-compliance in a very difficult position because you get neighbors that are very frustrated. Yes, it is an exception, but it's become, I guess, the severe exceptions that have created some problems. Greed, it's how do you write a law that doesn't punish those that are...
Well, I guess the question is two, I mean, I know other communities do it, but just because they do it doesn't mean it's the right thing to do.
Another option might be to deal with it by lot size, say 15,000 square foot or less to over that unlimited or however you do that.
As long as you meet the certain standards, you know, visibility and things like that. Kyle?
Well, ultimately, our goal is to avoid the visual clutter and the disruption to neighbors, whether it be when they're working on it, and that's addressed by noise ordinance and so forth. So the bottom line is right now, isn't our code just saying visual from the street?
Yes, visible beyond the lot boundaries, I believe that.
It's just beyond the lot boundaries because not just from the street, but from neighbors' perspective. You can't have the visual clutter. I mean, if I'm looking over my back fence and I can see everything, not at the fence, but just if I'm standing on my porch and looking out, and it's all trashy over the yard because there's not sufficient fence, you know, screening and so forth, that's a problem for me. Okay. So as long as we have sufficient screening in all directions and they are not disturbing, causing a disturbance by when they work on it and what they do, then we need to be cautious on how we proceed on regulating. But we need to make sure that we give staff the appropriate tools so that when somebody does violate, that they are able to address it. That's really what we're after.
If I could just add one thing, I've had the opportunity to talk to some of the residents that have problems with this, and it really is the problem of the resident adjacent to the house that can see it over the back fence. And I think the way our code currently reads, it can't be visible from the right-of-way, which is different from my backyard looking into my neighbor's backyard.
Well, especially if you live in a two-story house,
it's exactly,
and you're looking in there, and there is a junkyard that people can't see, but every morning I got to look down And some people would argue, well, that's what you get when you buy a two-story house. It's a tough problem.
Right.
How do we define it so we can give the code compliance, take care of the really egregious situations? I think there needs to be a differentiation based on lot size.
I mean,
you know, once again, and whether we're never going to get a perfect line, but maybe, you know, things 8,000 square feet and under have one type of limitation, or maybe 10,000, or I don't know what it is, maybe an R18 or an R115 or whatever the zoning category, you have one limitation. Maybe it's two cars for that. Above that, it's maybe a different standard. But with the screening and I think the public safety issues are pretty much covered in fire ordinance, fire code, and things like that. I mean, if you're back there creating a fire hazard, that's a fire code issue, which I think is probably pretty much covered in the fire code, and we would be able to go and do some things on that. I don't know if we use that, but I would guess that we can get the fire marshal in there and take care of the really bad situations that are public safety hazards.
I think that it's Mary nodding her head. That would be involved in that.
Yeah. Alex?
And what Ms. Lanka said, I think from any portion of the, there's got to be some terminology so it isn't right away, but the neighbor, you know, I think that's a fair way to look at it. And the philosophical background is, hey, I'm all for all property rights and highest and best use of your property until it starts to take down my highest and best use. And there's got to be some reasonableness there. Yeah.
I mean, I've seen some areas where people had cars that they were, you know, working on that had weeds that literally went up to the height of the car because they can't get in there and cut them. And so, you know, and that was hideous for the neighbors to have to look at that. And you couldn't see it from the street because it was immediately behind the house.
Okay, so we'll go back and come forward with some lot size regulations, that there's a continuum for number of vehicles based on the lot size, and then also fine-tune the language as far as visibility from adjacent properties.
Yeah, because I think one of the issues that Dennis had is that you're in a suburban neighborhood, probably on an 7,000 or 8,000 square foot lot, and you got four or five cars crammed in there, and you know that's tight because it's got a small backyard, and that's a whole different issue than if you're down in Lehigh or out in Dina's area where, you know, four cars would get lost.
Okay.
You don't even see them.
We'll come back with that.
Okay. As it relates to, I have a real issue with limiting total vehicles because if we start counting canoes, I'm sorry. I think deal with the issues that create problems for neighbors.
So, don't limit them.
I don't know. And on the yard sales, I know that there are, like in Kyle's neighborhood, and I think in some of my adjoining neighborhoods, people pretty much have perfected the craft of having non-business weekly yard sales. I don't know what the reasonable one is. I think 12 is, you know, frankly speaking, 12 crammed into a 4-month period, which is really when yard sales proliferate around here when it's cool, is like having one every week. I don't know, the four? That's the staff recommended?
Yeah, option C is staff recommendation. That's
our 1 a month? 1 a month?
Yard sales per year.
Well, if you did the 12 and you did 1 a month, then if there's a four-month season for yard sales, they could still only do four.
So you say 12, but one per calendar month?
Limited to one per month.
The administration of that is going to be
hard. Let's just say four per year. I'm seeing nods.
This is one of those instances where we have a group or a handful of really people, businesses, and we're changing the whole city. So, you know, grandmas can't hang out.
There's not a fuzzy line here. You know pretty well when someone's operating a business.
Okay.
You
got it.
Especially when most of the items they're selling have store price tag on them. They're not something my kid grew out of. All righty. Thank you. Is that good enough guidance for you? Or direct enough guidance? May not be good, but. Okay. Here, presentation, discuss new law regarding fees and charges. Candace.
Yes.
Your first official act.
My first official act.
Well, welcome.
And this is just going to be a really quick update for you on a new law that we need to actually start implementing this month. So we want to give you an update on how you're going to see that. With the new law regarding our fees and charges, and if you look on slide 2, we kind of broke out a piece of what the law is that we need to go to. And what it says is that a municipality that proposes to levy or assess a new tax or fee or proposes to increase an existing tax or fee shall provide written notice of the proposed charge on the home page of the municipality's website at least 60 days before the date the proposed new tax or fee is approved by the governing body. So what that changes a little bit for us is to actually post on our website that we have a process that we're following. So it doesn't change the process that we're following. It changes the fact that we have to post it on our home site that this process is coming 60 days before you actually act on the fee or charge that we come to you with. So what we're proposing to do to meet this requirement is we've given you a sample of what you're going to see posted on our website. And we'll actually be posting this later this afternoon. So this will go up live today. On the bottom right-hand side of our home site is where you see we have those little buttons. If you see we have our ABC button, our MacFest, our Water Use It Wisely. So down in that area, it's on the bottom right-hand side. You'll see a new button, and that's this button down here. And it'll say the Mesa City Council will review and consider proposed increases to the parks, recreation, and commercial facilities, fees and charges in March of 2011. So that lets the citizens know that there is a fee that is being proposed. It's going through our normal process. That process has not changed. But it does let them know that it's upcoming. When they click on that, that's actually a link. And that will link over to the budget and research homepage, where we have a page that is dedicated to proposed fees and charges. So on this page is where we will actually put the schedule of what's being proposed to come forward. So if a citizen comes on, they can see where this particular fee is in the process, what the next step is, and if there's a chance for them to either attend a meeting or get additional information. At this time, we do not have the proposed fee for this one because it has not gone through the Parks Advisory Board yet. Once it goes through a Parks Advisory Board and they have a recommendation, at that point we will actually post what their recommendation is that will be going to Audit and Finance. So at that point they can actually go out, click on the link where you see Parks and Recreation is underlined. That's actually a link. If you click on it today, it'll actually say that the information is pending. Once you go through the advisory board, you'll actually see the recommendation as it goes to Audit and Finance. Once you come out of Audit and Finance, you'll see that recommendation that's going to go to Council. As we have specific dates for those meetings, we'll update this page with those dates. So that'll be going out today. Just to give you an update on where we are in our fees and charges for our upcoming budget cycle, Parks, Recreation, and Commercial Facilities goes out of cycle of our normal budget cycle. The reason they need to do this is because they need to have their fees in place before the summer schedules come out. So this is why we had to actually implement this requirement a little earlier than our normal fees and charges. So that's why we're actually posting. They are scheduled to meet January 12th for their advisory board. This requirement requires us to post by January 20th. We're going to go ahead and post this today. So this will be up and running today. So we will be within the 60-day notice. They're scheduled to go to audit and finance sometime in February with council action on it on March 21st. The dates of their effective fees will go in of April 1st. Our normal fees and charges process, which coincides with our budget cycle, will come forward. The departments are working on those proposed changes right now, reviewing their revenues. They're going to come to the budget office on February 3rd. They'll go to audit and finance in March. Our deadline to post it to the website will be April 21st. We'll more than meet that deadline because we'll post as soon as we are ready for audit and finance. So we'll follow the same format that we're following for Parks and Rec. For Parks and Recreation, we just have a tighter timeline to get all that done. They'll follow our normal budget cycle, which is June 6th will be introduction of fees that are fee-related ordinances. June 20th is when we'll have council action on resolutions and ordinances. Anything that uses a resolution will be effective July 1st. Anything that requires an ordinance will be effective on August 1st.
Vice Mayor.
From a legal standpoint, then, when it's going back to the House Bill 2257, mm-hmm. that we need to give notice of the proposed changes 60 days in advance.
Correct.
Now, does that mean that if we as a council decide differently than what is presented to us, then we have to wait an additional 60 days for that change? Or just notice that there is going to be a change and Correct. Here's the proposed, but Correct. Not necessarily the final?
Right. Correct. It's just a notice that we are revising our fees, and so we will post that 60 days before council action. So between that notice and the council action, the fee recommendations may change as it goes through our normal fee and fee process.
So we're comfortable that we don't have to play that game, because just reading it, when it said provide written notice of the proposed charge on the home page, if we make a change as a council, that's the proposed charge for us to approve. We don't have to wait another 60 days.
Yeah, Mayor, Vice Mayor, the statute doesn't say, but I think a reasonable interpretation is that the intent of the statute is to let the citizens know that fees are going to be considered and maybe increased by the council. That way they have sufficient opportunity to voice their opinion and come provide input to the council before the decision is made.
So our reading of it is that by giving them 60 days before it's heard at the board, at that point in time, they'll hear what the charge is. So they'll know at that time.
Well, we are hoping to give them as much information. Even if we say that the increase is going to be $2 on this fee, if the council changes it, we believe the council still has the discretion to change it. But we're going to give the citizens what the proposed change is as soon as we can.
Gotcha.
And again, Candace said it. It probably wouldn't be as time sensitive if we were going through the budget process, because we could delay implementation of a fee. But because this gets put out in the summer brochures and online that people rely upon to sign up for summer classes, there is a definitely time sensitive to this.
It would seem like the purpose of the law is to tell people, with plenty of advance, that something's coming down. Here's the meetings. You can ask questions. You've got notice, so you can be part of the process. And there's a proposed charge. As opposed to just putting on an agenda, it goes through, boom, and it's enacted.
Yeah. Okay. This is a change. It's a little bit different. Because we have to post it, we just didn't want it. We wanted council to be aware of why we were doing that.
And once again, just by posting it doesn't mean that
council could choose not to do any of the fee increases.
Because I can just see the headlines when you put that on there. City of Mesa 2 increase. No, we're noticing that we're going to have hearings or a formal process to review and analyze. Okay. All right. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
And you done did well.
Thank you.
Hear reports on conferences and or meetings attended. Do you have anything to report over the last, what you did on your Christmas vacation? I will say real quickly, I went to the first few minutes of the A.T. Still council meeting this morning, and they have some exciting things going on out at AT Still, an important part of our community. They're adding a whole floor of dental training and clinical type stuff, which is pretty exciting. So there's some great things going on in our community. And I just, this morning I went to a meeting of one of our real stellar citizens in AT Still. They mean a lot to our community, and we appreciate what they do, what they bring to Mason. So that was the one thing I got. Anything else? Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, this morning we have a visitor. Danette Harris is a Mesa Leadership student this semester and is a Boeing employee, and is she shadowing me today? So I actually have
and
a friend who will talk
no
to me today.
No shadow jokes. I learned that two years
ago. You did. Ago. Yes, you did. What was that joke, by
no,
the way?
No, no. Don't go there.
So welcome, Danette.
Welcome, Danette. Anything else? Mr. Brady.
Yes, Mayor and Council, we will have a council meeting, our first one of the year, January 10th. And then we have our next study session will be January 13th. We are coming up on the Martin Luther King celebration. There will be a dinner banquet on Saturday, January 15th. And then, of course, the Martin Luther King parade will be Monday, January 17th at 11 a.m., which will be followed by a festival at the Mesa Arts Center from noon to 5 p.m. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Crocker, any requests to speak?
No requests, Mayor.
All righty. There's no further business. I have a motion to adjourn from Councilmember Richens, a second from the Vice Mayor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you very much. We are adjourned.